the J-Talk Podcast.
よしよしよしよし。
山で戻す。ルーズなシュートだ。
ゴール。来た。
三笘です。先制日本。
三笘。
三笘。行くカットイン。自分で運んでシュートだ
ー。すごい。
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, the Samurai Blue are through. It's just a shame about the, I guess, the hangover, you'd call it, on Tuesday night after the big success in Sydney last Thursday.
Yeah, I was all ready to be positive about Japan for perhaps the first time in this qualification phase. And yeah, unfortunately, that tonight against Vietnam, it wasn't a great performance. The players that came in didn't really take their chance. So yeah, a little bit disappointing. But the good news is that Japan have made it. They'll be in Qatar in the autumn or winter. And yeah, good luck to them. But yeah, there are still a few major issues that need to be ironed out in this squad.
Yes, most definitely. So Japan have qualified for their seventh straight World Cup, and that is thanks to a 2-0 away win over Australia in Sydney last Thursday night. The result was only settled right at the death with Kaoru Mitoma, the late substitute and a player we'd been clamoring to see for so long in the Samurai Blue shirt, Sam. Coming off the bench and to say he had a decisive impact is a massive understatement. Obviously a draw would have suited Japan as well, but the fact that they were able to seal qualification with a game to spare was very, very sweet, coming up against one of their major rivals in Asia. So to do it in Sydney and to win in Australia for the first time in over 20 years was a very, very sweet one for the Japanese side.
Yeah, very much so. And I thought for large parts of the game, Japan played very well. They were dominant, I thought, in midfield. And you always get kind of the stereotypical viewpoint that Australia will be too much physically for Japan and Japan will struggle. But it was completely the opposite, I thought, in this game. That midfield three were pressing from the off. They were right in the Australian faces. They caused a lot of problems, I thought, for Australia. They hung on well, Australia, and I mean they did have a goal that probably should have counted earlier in the game, but I just thought Japan were pretty relentless, and eventually it took a spark from Mitoma coming on, because poor Minamino was having one of those days where absolutely nothing was going right for him. But yeah, Mitoma comes on, does what we saw him do time and again for Kawasaki, and he has done as well in Belgium for Union. Just comes on, has that immediate impact and scores two very good goals. I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of fortune, obviously, with the second one and the poor goalkeeping, but the run from Mitoma was fantastic. So, yeah, it was a great statement from him, and it was great for Japan to just see themselves through as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and it completed a terrific turnaround, it must be said, in the final qualification phase. And we've been critical of the manager Hajime Moriyasu, his selections, his methods throughout this entire qualification process. But I mean, Sam, although it hasn't always been easy to watch, and yeah, arguably this was their best performance against Australia away, and then finish the qualification phase with a bit of a damp squib at home against Vietnam was a little bit disappointing. But the fact that after the first three qualifiers of this final group stage, they were 6 points behind both Saudi Arabia and Australia, having lost two of their first three games out of 10, of course, in this final qualification phase. So the fact that they were able to turn it around and, as we said, seal qualification with a game to spare, I guess it says quite a lot about the way Australia fell off. And there's a lot of caveats around the team they're able to put out and the circumstances behind all their COVID related problems heading into this crunch qualifier. But at the end of the day, you've got to play the team that's in front of you, and I agree that Japan were the better side for significant portion of that game. And ultimately Yeah, it's frustrating for me, obviously, as an Australian with a foot in both camps. But yeah, ultimately, Japan deserved it. And they've just about deserved it, I think, over the course of the final qualification phase as well.
Yeah, just about. And we've gone on a lot about the kind of deficiencies in the way that Moriyasu has set up this side. But the one key change that was made after that, that loss to Saudi Arabia, it went to that midfield three and brought in Tanaka alongside Morita and Endo. And I thought that those three came out for the rest of the qualifying. They were fantastic. They had that right balance of Endo, especially at the holding midfield. And then you've got the two former Kawasaki players that can go forward. They can do a little bit of everything. And I thought that was really the turning point for Japan. I mean, everyone would have liked to have seen a Kubo in the number 10, or Minamino, or Doan, Kamada. We've got so many for Japan. It's not usual necessarily for a Japan side not to play with that position, but it really helped the way that Moriyasu was setting up his team. It kind of made sure they were a lot more solid in midfield. It protected the defence more, and that's where it really worked for him. I mean, I think there is definitely a way of getting Japan to be playing more proactive, more with perhaps with a number 10, or just more attacking-wise, but for a Moriyasu team, this was the best way to set it up, and he got that decision right.
Indeed. And on last week's episode, the three of us, you, myself and Johnny, we were speculating on the 11 he might pick for the Australia game. And I think we pretty much got it spot on, Sam. We all plumped for Ko Itakura ahead of Shogo Taniguchi alongside Maya Yoshida in central defence. I'm not sure if we all wanted to see Yuto Nagatomo at left back. It sounds like Pickle definitely did. But that was, unsurprisingly, that was Moriyasu's decision, picking Nagatomo at left back and with leaving Yuta Nakayama in reserve, and Miki Yamane playing on the right of the back four with Takuma Asano starting up front ahead of ISA Wada. I hoped, as I said on last week's episode, that Wada would come on and show enough in his cameo, however long that might have been, to merit a start against Vietnam on Tuesday. And I think that bore fruit, and Wada was impressive after coming on and was given a chance by Moriyasu to start against Vietnam, got through 90 minutes and actually had the ball in the net, only for it to be disallowed due to an offside in the build-up. But we'll obviously come on to Tuesday night's game shortly. But you mentioned earlier, Sam, it was just a horror show for Takumi Minamino, wasn't it, on Thursday in Sydney? I mean, from the first 30 seconds he was involved, shooting too close to Matthew Ryan. But I think it was 7 shots in total for Minamino, and so many of them so close, and blocks, and hit the bar twice, and just as you say, it wasn't his night. I think he played really, really well, but he probably should have had 4 or 5 goals. So on the balance of it, there's definitely plenty to be critical about his finishing, especially. But it was just one of those where it just would not go in for him, would it?
Yeah, he was just having one of those nights. The good thing about it was getting in the positions, I suppose, and it was kind of getting into the places where Wada would have liked someone to get into tonight, because Wada really had much support in that front area. But Minamino definitely got in to help Asano. Everything fell to him, but it's just radar was completely off. But I did feel quite sorry for him in the end. But it's not like the first time that this has happened. There are plenty of occasions where Minamino has seemed to have had all the chances for Japan but had been wasteful in front of goal. This was another one, perhaps one of the worst ones that we've seen from him. It is really unfortunate because he was playing well, as you said, but that lack of cutting edge, I mean, it's just a constant thing, and it's just it's so frustrating for him. And I think he was involved as well with a disallowed goal tonight, so if he can't score, nobody can score, and he's going to rule those out as well.
Yes, indeed. Now, you mentioned earlier the goal, in inverted commas, for Australia that probably should have stood 25 minutes into the game last Thursday night, Sam, when Australia swung a corner into the box and Trent Sainsbury jumped into Shuichi Gonda with the referee blowing for a foul as Miki Yamane headed into his own net while tussling with Gianni Stensness. So the decision stood after the VAR check, but I think had the whistle not blown, I don't think the goal would have been overturned, Sam.
Yeah, I think Japan definitely got away with one there. There was minimal contact, if anything. I think the referee's seen a slight coming together and has awarded the free kick. But yeah, I think it was very fortunate, and Japan could have had no complaints if that goal was allowed or not. Yeah, I think it should have been. It would have been against the run of play, I thought, at that point. But yeah, it was a goal that definitely should have stood for Australia.
Indeed. So then the in-between chances missed by Takumi Minamino. Australia had a couple of really good chances either side of half time, with Aiden Hristich sending over a terrific cross from the right in the 40th minute, and a completely unmarked Mitch Duke headed straight at Shuichi Gonda from alongside the penalty spot. That had come a couple of minutes after Duke had tried to divert a shot from outside the box that went just wide of Gonda's right-hand post. As Australia, yeah, had a couple of chances, as I say, before the break, and then immediately after it, the very impressive Hristich drew a save from Gonda from a free kick and then fired just wide with a strike from distance early in the second half. So, yeah, I think we're agreed that over the course of the 90 minutes, Sam, that Japan were the better team, but Australia did certainly have their moments, didn't they?
Yeah, they definitely did. That start of the second half, I thought they were right on it, and Hristich was involved in absolutely everything. And Japan had to weather that storm a little bit, Gonda had to make a couple of saves, and I thought generally the defence stood up pretty well, Itakura and Yoshida. But yeah, they just got through that period and were able to settle in, I thought, from about the hour mark onwards, and then wrestled control back. But yeah, there were moments in the first and second half where Australia, although on the back foot for a lot of the game, did look like they could have scored a goal. So yeah, well done to Japan for managing to get through those periods. So yeah, they are going to be tested, of course, in these sorts of games away against Australia. But they came through that well, and then yeah, got their rewards in the end.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll just work through the substitutions for Japan and the impact that they had. It was written in stone that Nakayama would come on for Nagatomo around the hour mark, and that was indeed the case in the 63rd minute when Wada also replaced Asano. Asano did have a decent chance just before he was taken off, but yeah, mishit his shot, and Ryan was able to claim quite comfortably. Once Wada came on, 6 minutes after, in fact, he shot just wide with a fine strike from outside the box, similar to the goal he scored against Shonan in Kashima's last league game, which I think it was Kengo Nakamura mentioned as well on the DAZN commentary. And then, the major... Not necessarily the turning point in the game, but yeah, the key substitution made by Moriyasu was Mitoma coming on for Minamino in the 84th minute when Genki Haraguchi also entered the fray for Ao Tanaka. So it's one of those, Sam, isn't it, where we've clamoured for Mitoma for so long, and yeah, he wasn't getting the opportunity. So then Moriyasu brings him on with 6 minutes to go in a 0-0 game, and he goes on to score two goals before the full time whistle blows. So is Moriyasu a genius for holding him back, or should he have unleashed him far earlier? And Japan's nerves might have been settled a long time before the 89th minute. What turned out to be the winner.
Yeah, I saw the arguments there. Yeah, it was just good management from Moriyasu to bring him on. But it's, I think I put it in the line chat that we have for Patreons, and it was just like the France manager leaving Mbappe on the bench and then just taking the plaudits when he comes on with 5 minutes to go and does something. Just start him. And you can see tonight, obviously, that he didn't get his goal, but he was the most creative, the most threatening player that Japan had, and he would do that throughout the entire 90 minutes. And yeah, he could have put the game to bed a lot earlier than the last 5 minutes, where Japan were still, as with Australia, still attacking, still could have nicked a goal. So yeah, just put the game out of bed and play your best players from the start. Yeah, it's not great management just because you've saved Mitoma for the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Point well made, mate. All right, so yeah, it was a goal straight off the Kawasaki Frontale. Asao training ground in the 89th minute. Hidemasa Morita received from Miki Yamane with his back to goal and played in a just onside Yamane with a return pass. Yamane cut the ball back from the byline with the ball seemingly taking ages to roll across the box before Mitoma arrived in the nick of time to steer a low finish past Matt Ryan. And then in the 94th minute, with Australia very much on their last legs, Mitoma surged past his man on the left and dribbled across the box before driving low with the ball, squirming through Ryan's grasp and trickling over the line. The Australian keeper punching the floor in frustration at, a number of things, I guess. In the immediate aftermath of conceding a goal that he most definitely should not have, but also the fact that, yes, he well and truly was aware at that point that the game was gone and the jig was up for Australia in terms of automatic qualification. And, for them, Sam, it's very much for them, for us, I'm Australian, of course, it's very much a missed opportunity. As I said, after the fast start they had made to the group alongside Saudi Arabia, when obviously the pair of them would have been odds on favourite to make it through automatically. Japan, as we said, deserve credit for turning things around and winning six straight qualifiers before tonight's draw. But I guess this is probably a question that I would be better for me to answer. But again, I'm talking about FC Tokyo, I'm not very concise with my words. So I'm not sure. Maybe I should leave this to you. Australia overall, again, with the caveats from the squad they were able to put out for the Japan game. But overall, it's a very, very disappointing end to the qualification phase that obviously had begun so brightly.
Yeah, and I think the qualification was settled beforehand. I mean, it wasn't just this game against Japan that cost Australia. They had draws with China, very poor China, draws with Oman as well. And I think, they really cost them. I thought the team that you were able to put out against Japan, I thought, was pretty weak. Obviously, you were missing quite a few players due to injury and COVID and whatnot. I mean, just to lose your midfield three of Moy, Rogic and Irvine, that's very difficult, especially against Japan's midfield three. So this was an unfortunate one, the position that Australia were putting in, and given the players that were out, I thought they played fairly well. But I just think previous performances, and when you were as you say, in such a good position to go and draw with China and to draw with Oman, and then not to have beaten either of Japan or Saudi Arabia at home, I think it's quite disappointing. And Australian football from the outside, it seems like in an interesting position now. And how vital do you think qualification to the World Cup is? Obviously, you've got to go through one of Iraq and the UAE first, and then looking like Peru from CONMEBOL as well. How likely do you think that is, and how important is it for Australian football?
It's huge, obviously, for us, Sam. I'd back us in a one-off game against the third-place team from Group A, and then it's obviously a huge one against the fifth place nation from South America. I mean, we've obviously handled that before to qualify for 2006, that famous win on penalties against Uruguay. It's huge for a number of reasons. The game hasn't really, or the national team hasn't really kicked on as many of us would have hoped in the last, 6 or 8 years. And, it could be the last opportunity to play at a World Cup for stalwarts like, Aaron Moy and Trent Sainsbury and Matt Ryan, et cetera. I know, obviously, goalkeepers have a pretty long lifespan these days, so maybe it won't be Ryan's last dance. But, there's a number of things that make it vitally important for Australia that we make it through. Obviously, the interest in the A-League in many respects is tied to the performance of the national team. Obviously, there are dyed-in-the-wool supporters of each club that maybe aren't necessarily bothered whether Australia make it or not, but a lot of casual eyes will drift away from the A-League if there's no World Cup interest for the Socceroos. So all we can do as Australians is trust in our backs to the wall mentality and hope that we can at least Well, yeah, first things first, make it past the third place team from Group A, and then we'll see how we go against whichever South American nation fronts up. But yeah, again, not at my most concise talking about Australia as I am with FC Tokyo on a fairly regular basis on the podcast. But ultimately, as we've said, a deserved win for Japan, and that saw them qualified for their seventh straight World Cup. Then, Sam, you put out a wish list of players you hope to see start against Vietnam with one caveat in goal. And, well, you turned out to be Nostradamus, because pretty much everything you hoped for and wished against happened in Hajime Moriyasu's selection for the home game against Vietnam, as he made nine changes to his starting 11. But a 1-1 draw despite the 24-1 shot count. I don't think Japan can have too many complaints, can they? Because they it was just one of those frustrating nights at Saitama Stadium that I guess we've somewhat become accustomed to.
Yeah, I thought it was really poor. I mean, defensively, Vietnam were really up for the game, and they started quite quickly, and Japan struggled to kind of contain them. They played a midfield three of Shibasaki, Haraguchi, and Hatate, and I don't think there's a defensive bone between the three of them. And it kind of allowed a bit of space for Vietnam to exploit. They got themselves a corner, and then Nakayama and Yoshida were left 3-on-2 at the back post. And yeah, they profited from that and got their goal, and that's exactly what they were after. They could then sit back and soak up the pressure. And Japan, although they had a lot of possession in that first half, they were very poor with it. None of the attacks really kind of were cohesive. There wasn't a great deal of link-up play. I thought generally they looked kind of threatening whenever the ball was played down Mitoma's side. He'd stretch the fullback and he'd get into decent positions, but generally he either didn't find anyone with his cross, or he pulled it back to Nakayama, who would whip in a cross. But then Japan only had Kubo coming in at the back, and yeah, towering back far post headers aren't necessarily his forte. So yeah, it just really wasn't working for them. They changed things up a little bit in the second half. Hatate went off at half time. I think it was a little harsh. I don't think he was necessarily the worst player there, but maybe there was an agreement with Celtic to get him off and send him back to Glasgow ahead of the Old Firm derby at the weekend. But it eventually got better, I suppose, when Morita came on and Tanaka came on. Ito was the replacement at half time and started to create a few more chances, started to look a little more threatening, but then just didn't really take the chances. A couple were disallowed for a handball from Minamino, and then a close offside, and Maya Yoshida missed one of the misses of the season. It was channeling his inner Takumi Minamino with that one. And sorry, Dan, I've just stolen that joke off you. It was just really frustrating, that second half performance. Although the intensity was a lot better, and it did seem like they were creating half chances, there wasn't necessarily anything too clear cut bar that Yoshida, well, the two Yoshida chances that he had. So yeah, pretty disappointing, but yeah, kind of par for the course, I suppose, for watching this Japan side. It was never going to end on a high.
Yeah, that's right. And so, it was Maya Yoshida who equalised 9 minutes into the second half after the keeper could only parry Genki Haraguchi's shot. And then, Japan had two goals disallowed. Ultimately, I guess correctly, the handball by Minamino, well, he obviously didn't know anything about it, but it hit his hand before bouncing up into his face before Tanaka swept it home. And then the offside to deny Wada was actually Tanaka as well, wasn't it, over on the far side? He headed across goal and Wada swept home, but again Tanaka was offside when the ball was clipped over to him. And then just a dreadful miss by Yoshida, but that a central defender's shot from inside the 6-yard box, I suppose you could say. And then, again, it just wasn't Minamino's international break, was it? Because he was half a toenail away from getting a touch onto the shot from Yoshida as it went across the box and wide of the post. So Well, yeah, it's one of those for Japan, isn't it? Yeah, they obviously started this final qualification phase with a 1-0 defeat at home at the hands of Oman. And then after sealing qualification, they've finished it with a 1-1 draw against Vietnam. So, one step forward. Well, not quite two steps back, but I mean, what should have been a celebration of qualification. And as you said at the start, Sam, a chance for a number of players to really stake a claim for firstly a spot in the squad, and secondly, perhaps a more regular role in the first team was spurned by a number of players. We obviously know that a lot of these who were spot starters tonight will definitely be on the plane to Qatar, fitness permitting. I mean, the likes of Takefusa Kubo, Yuta Nakayama, who is 1B, very much 1B to Yuta Nagatomo, 1A at left back, etc. I just wonder then, over the course of these 10 games, Sam, it's obviously a lot to take in, all the way back in September when Japan played Oman to play the first of these final 10 group stage games. Maybe the players that have done themselves the most good in terms of locking up a spot in we presume it's going to be Hajime Moriyasu's World Cup 23 or the Japan World Cup managers squad of 23. Which players have really enhanced their prospects, do you think, over the course of this final qualification phase?
I mean, we can always hope Moriyasu goes the way of Halil Hodžić and doesn't make it to the World Cup. But I imagine he will be. So we'll play with this formation. I think in the formation, Endo, I think, has come out of this campaign like almost as Japan's most important player. The way that he's taken that holding midfield role, he's the orchestrator in there, defensively very good, involved in the pressing as well. He gets forward too. So I think he's all round been the best player for Japan in this qualifying campaign. Obviously, Junya Ito and his goals have bailed out the squad on numerous occasions. He has had a kind of coming of age qualification period. Yeah, I think he's been magnificent on that right hand side. And just that midfield three, I think, is probably like Alton Aka has gone into this now. I think he's nailed on now for a start, which he definitely wasn't at the start of qualifying. There may have been, especially the way it's not really working out for him at Fortuna Dusseldorf, but his performances for the national team have always been very good. He's generally the one that's involved. He scored that big goal against Australia in the home game. So I think he's got himself on the plane and definitely in the first 11 by the looks of it. So same with Hidemasa Morita. So those four, I think, are the main ones that have come out with the most credit. I still think you're going to have question marks about I think Gonda is probably the goalkeeper, although I don't think he necessarily is the greatest goalkeeper that is out there. But I don't think Japan are blessed with great options in that position. Right back, I think Yamane has done very well every time that he's played, and it could be a challenge for Hiroki Sakai. I think at the moment he'd probably still plump with Sakai, but Yamane, I think, has been very good. And the other concerns we have, left back, I think it is that change, those two. And then striker is going to be the issue as well. Like Ueda, I thought, I really like Ueda, and I think he plays very well for Kashima, but Kashima get a lot of players in and around him. And in this formation, the 4-3-3, the midfield, I think, is a bit too far away from him. And without Minamino on the left, no one's really coming into it and kind of assist the centre-forward. So I just think, although there are his detractors for Yuya Osako, I do think he is the best fit for the way that they play. It might not be the greatest way to play or the way that most people want to play for Japan, but in this system, I do think Osako probably still has that position. So, still a few questions to ask, but those midfield three and Junya Ito, I think, are the main ones. Anyone else that stood out for you?
I've always enjoyed Nakayama, and even as an FC Tokyo supporter, I'd just prefer Nakayama to be starting ahead of Nagatomo. So that's a blasphemous thing to say, obviously, from an FC Tokyo supporter, but especially as I put the feelers out in the line group earlier on, Sam. I'm not sure, as the last time I checked, that nobody had gotten back to answer. It sounds like Pickle might be able to. Do you know if it's going to be five substitutions allowed at the World Cup, or whether it will only be back to three?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know if it's been confirmed yet. I think because the rules then they change on July the 1st, is whenever any new IFAB ruling comes in. So I think you'll have to wait until then before they decide if five subs, first of all, are actually allowed still, and if that's going to continue. I imagine it will do. I can't imagine the COVID situation is going to have gone away sufficiently by then. And I think, yeah, most managers will want and plump for five substitutions. So I imagine that will be the case.
Right, right. Well, in that case, and again, with the huge caveat is if Moriyasu is the manager, then I would expect that the players that have got him this far will retain their places, and that would that means as we build up to the final squad announcement. I mean, yeah, it might come down to a straight decision between the likes of Ueda and Daisen Maeda to be the third striker, but behind Yuya Osako and Takuma Asano, even though Osako and Asano most definitely have their detractors. It might just come down to the tried and trusted for Moriyasu, and we might all be pulling our hair out, but that's just I think that just seems to be the way he's going to operate. So, I mean, yeah, the main reason I asked about the three versus five substitutions is because, I think if it's only three, then I don't think changing your left back at 60 minutes in every game becomes a major priority for a manager, does it? So in that case, I would just plump for Nakayama to start, and as I said earlier, I would do that anyway. But if it's Moriyasu and he's stuck in his ways, then I just wonder if it's three substitutions instead of five, that he might be of a similar mind to me, or whether he'll just stick with Nagatomo for as long as he can in each particular game. But as for the star performers across the group stage, I mean, it's got to be Ito. The goals in four straight qualifiers, obviously the first two of those games were 1-0 wins that he decided. I don't think he was at his most effective in these final two qualifiers in Australia. Obviously, he had the cross that Minamino headed against the bar, so that was a potential assist there. That was, as we said, it just wasn't Minamino's night. But over the course of the qualification phase, he's well and truly, justified the faith that Moriyasu was put in him. And Endo is, as you say, an absolute standout and absolutely terrific performer. The goalkeeper situation. Obviously, we've got a lot of time to chat about this before November, Sam. But there are definitely a number of question marks. But a number of players have enhanced their prospects over the course of this this final qualification phase. And again, we're frustrated with the players that have come in and not taken their chances tonight. And I guess there's two ways of looking at it, aren't there, Sam? I mean, the players that have been waiting for this opportunity and will have been desperate to grasp it, but then should we cut them a break in the fact that they haven't this team will have not played together at all. Although I did notice that Tony D made a good point in the line group that this second string would have been practicing against the first team for most of their training sessions, surely. So maybe there should have been more familiarity than there appeared to be. But I don't know, a player like Takefusa Kubo, who has always had such high expectations on him and did see a lot of the ball tonight against Vietnam, but again, not one of those nights for him where it just didn't go for him. And, as I said, there's no danger of him missing the plane, but potentially a missed opportunity for him to stamp a claim on a first team spot here.
Yeah, I think that's right. He didn't play particularly well. I don't think he's really had a great game necessarily in a Japan shirt, especially in a game that's a meaningful qualifier. I think he's had reasonable performances in certain friendlies and certain games against lesser opposition. But yeah, this was a real chance for him, and I don't think he stepped up. But that was kind of the same for everyone. It did look, as I said before, a very disjointed performance. Yes, they have trained a lot, and there should be a little bit more cohesiveness than was on show. But it's kind of, it's a different atmosphere when you're actually playing in front of, what was it, 42,000, I think they managed to get at Saitama, and it just didn't click for them. And I don't think anyone should be written off based on one performance in what was a dead rubber. And maybe the entire atmosphere of the squad was like, okay, we were already through, and there was kind of a bit more of a relaxed attitude. But yeah, it was a real shame that you didn't see anyone in that team really stamp their authority and stake a claim for a starting position. They were given the opportunity. You can argue that certain tactical things didn't really help them. I thought that midfield three were just without instruction by the looks of it. There wasn't anyone there that was meant to sit and cover the defence. There wasn't any sort of, it was kind of a free for all at the moment. You saw all three going forward and then all three a little bit lost. So maybe there are caveats in that the setup and the tactics weren't necessarily to their liking and to the players' preference. But yeah, it was disappointing. And no one, even Mitoma, I thought played quite well. I don't think he necessarily in this game showed everything that he can do.
Mm. Yes, indeed. All right, then. So that wraps up the qualification phase then for the Samurai Blue. And their ticket to Qatar is punched. The draw for the World Cup group stage will be made in the early hours of Saturday morning, with the tournament, of course, beginning on November the 21st. As of recording, we're not sure, of course, which pot Japan will be placed in. They were number 23 in the last FIFA rankings that were released in February, but I believe that new rankings will be released before the World Cup draw is made. So, it's likely to be pot two or three for Japan. Perhaps a win tonight might have seen them sneak into to pot two in terms of how the rankings will shake out. And we're not really sure. Smarter minds than us will certain of that fact or not. But we'll wait and see. Obviously, and Saudi Arabia have to play later on against Australia, Sam. So I don't know. Will whoever finishes top of this group have any impact on that, do you think?
No, I think, Dan Olowitz posted a World Cup group draw simulator earlier that I've been playing with for a lot. And it's got the FIFA ranking points on there, and it's all up to date as of the last game that was played. So Saudi Arabia are too far behind to catch up Japan. And Japan, if they'd have won, they could have gone into pot two, but we're relying on results like North Macedonia beating Portugal and Poland beating Sweden, I think. So yeah, they're very much confirmed now in pot three, and right in the middle of it as it stands.
Okay, fair enough then. That's good. We know that ahead of everything that will come, as I said, in the early hours of Saturday morning. So that wraps it up for the Samurai Blue. Obviously, Australia, in terms of Asian qualifiers, they still have to play the third place nation from Group A in a one off match in Doha on June the 7th. That will be either the UAE or Iraq. With the winner, as we said earlier, facing the fifth-placed CONMEBOL nation again in a one-off match in Doha on either June the 13th or the 14th. That will be against either Peru, Colombia, or Chile. And, obviously, as an Australian, my fingers crossed, to make it through on the June the 7th. And then, whatever happens the next week, we'll wait and see. So that's it for Japan. And so we return to domestic action on the weekend, Sam, with the J1 Match Day 6 beginning on Friday night, with the Fukuoka hosting Tosu in a Kyushu derby. There's a couple of other tasty looking games amongst the eight to be played on Saturday. Obviously, I'll be watching behind the couch and through my fingers when FC Tokyo visit Yokohama F. Marinos in one of the late games at 7 o'clock on Saturday. But and where's your interest lie on the match day six fixtures?
Yeah, well, I think you've picked out the big one, but the one I'm going to look at is Vissel Kobe against Kyoto Sanga. Obviously, Luis Planaguma, I think I've pronounced that right, or at least close. This is his first game in charge, so I'll be really interested to see how he sets up that Kobe team, how he goes about sorting that team out. They've signed Kenta Hashimoto, which won't be great music to your ears as an FC Tokyo supporter, but yeah, he's coming hopefully to replace Sergi Samper, who's out with a long-term injury, so it'll be interesting if he's up to speed at all. It was obviously a very weird situation to come over from Rostov in the middle of the season, in the middle of a contract there, but yeah, I'd be wondering if he can slot in or if he's fit enough to play. And just, yeah, they've got to have a response pretty quickly. They need that new manager bounce. They can't just keep going, especially into the ACL, and keep going without victories, because they find themselves stuck in that relegation zone, and when they come back from their ACL exploits, they could be in a cut adrift place. So yeah, that's the game I've been looking forward to. Kyoto have managed to set up quite well against stronger teams, Reds, Cerezo, etc. So yeah, that's a big one, and I'm not sure that defence is set up to cope with big Peter Utaka.
I did spot that one, and I thought that looked very intriguing as well myself. And also, well, the only two teams below Kobe in the table square off an hour earlier at the Lemon Gas Stadium when the Shonan entertained Hiroshima. I think, we've been quite impressed with Hiroshima over the past couple of match days when Michael Skibber has entered the country. So it does appear that 17th is a false position for Sanfrecce, and they'll be looking to exploit the lack of confidence at Shonan and try and get their first victory of the season. But well, on the flip side, of course, Belmare see this as the perfect opportunity to net their first win of the season as well. So some would say that's got 0-0 written all over it, but for me that is one of the more interesting fixtures on the match day 6 slate. So we'll leave it there, Sam. It's obviously great to have Japan qualified for the World Cup, as you said a couple of months ago. I mean, we are the J-Talk podcast, so despite my Australian allegiance, we simply couldn't not have Japan at the World Cup, could we? I mean, I wonder how people that host podcasts on Italian football are feeling at the moment. They obviously must be extremely frustrated and depressed about it. But as we said, a bit of a hangover on Tuesday night, a really frustrating way to end the qualification phase. But they are in Qatar. Their ticket is punched. And I guess at certain points of qualification phase, that was gravely in doubt. So, it's good to have them there, first and foremost.
Yeah, very relieved that they're there. I was fearing we might have to go back to those early stages of COVID where we're scrambling around for ideas week on week. So thankfully they're there and we've got them to talk about throughout November and December. And hopefully they can go a long way. The groups always, they all look difficult. Every one that I've simulated, often with us with Japan having Germany as their pot two team. So let's hope that doesn't happen. And hopefully there's not an easy game in there. You'd probably pick the United States out of that pot two, and unfortunately they can't draw Qatar, so it's going to be difficult, but hopefully it's a really exciting draw, and I'm sure we'll get into that next week.
Another topic for discussion on next week's episode. Before we finish though, Sam, a lot of listeners will be wondering, how's Pickle getting on?
She's made me use the mute button quite a lot throughout this podcast, so hopefully she hasn't caused too much of a disturbance, but she's finally settled down in the final 3 minutes of recording, so that's good.
Terrific stuff. All right, so we'll leave it there. That's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up all of the J1 Match Day 6 games. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
すごい。